Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
All right, today we're going to finish, I hope, Rashi on the back half of our story. So we're episode number 3, the meeting between Yaakov and between Esav. We are in the back half of that meeting, which if you want to look at these, these are the sheets, the pink part of the sheet in which they now actually have the dialogue. We had the preparation for the actual meeting, and then we have the actual meeting in which the two of them come face to face for the first time. And that part of the story has also two parts to it. As we continue to subdivide and understand all the different components of the story, we covered last week the first part in which Yaakov approaches his brother Esav by bowing down to him 7 times along the way. He divides up his camp, each one of the children with their specific mother. Each one of the children comes forward with his mother. Esav basically says, what is all of these things that you send me, all of these gifts? And who are all these people? Yaakov says, these are the family that Hashem has blessed me with. The gifts, please, if I found favor in your eyes, then take it. And Esav says, I have a lot. Keep it. And Yaakov says, no, I've seen your face. It's like the face of the angel that I just fought with. I have everything. You keep it. And he implores him, and he accepts it. That's what we got through last week. So now we're up to the point in which they've met. It seems basically friendly. If you recall last week, we had the fact that when they first saw Esav ran, embraced him, hugged him, kissed him, and then they cried, and we had the dots over the word that they kissed. And Rashi quoted the two different opinions from the sages, whether or not that means that this was the exception. The dots tell you this is exceptional. It was either exceptional because it wasn't a full-fledged kiss, even though the text seems to imply that it was, or it was exceptional and that this went against Esav's nature, and this actually was a fully intended, full-hearted kiss because all of his emotions were aroused. We also noted just briefly that Rashi commented that when Esav basically says, I don't need your gift, keep that which is yours, he was alluding to the fact that he acknowledged the blessings indeed belong to Yaakov, and that he was not going to fight him on it any longer. Okay, that was a brief synopsis of all that we did last week. So far, so good? Let us move forward. Okay, so if you have your pink sheet, let's just read a couple. You can read the verses out of the other sheet as well, but if you just want to see what we're going to be covering today. So the story then continues. Let's just read a little bit of the story outside to catch us up, and then we'll go back into Rashi. We concluded verse 11, Pasuk Yud Aleph, in the pink sheets yesterday, last week. We'll begin with a new dialogue and finish up this week. So now, after Yaakov prevails upon Esav, and Esav accepts all of the gifts that he had sent, thereupon he said, travel and we will go, and I will go alongside you. Now we have a new dialogue in which Esav says, let's travel together. We've had this meeting. I've accepted your gift. Now let us travel together. Verse 12, verse 13, Yaakov responds and says, my master knows that the children are tender and that the flocks and the cattle which are raising their young depend upon me. And if they overdrive them, one day all the flocks will die. And Yaakov here gives the response as to why he cannot walk alongside Esav. He says, he gives this long response, look, I'm in charge, it's nothing to do with me, I would love to walk with you. But what am I going to do with these flock? What am I going to do with the kids? If I push them too hard, if we move too fast, they're all going to die. You understand that, right, Esav? I'm going to lose all of my money, I'll lose all of my possessions by pushing them too fast. Therefore, he says in verse 14, let my master go ahead before his servant, and I will move at my own slow pace, according to the pace of the work that is before me, and according to the pace of the children, until I come to my master to say, here, you go, I'll catch up, I'll travel at my own pace. Esav then has a second argument, let me leave you with some of my people who are with me. So good. I understand that you're going to lose all your flock and your cattle and your children might be damaged by the quick pace. So I'll go up on ahead, but I have these 400 men. Let me at least leave some of them here with you. A second effort that Esav makes or offers to be able to walk alongside of Yaakov. And Esau, Yaakov responds, but why do that? Let me find favor in your eyes, again in my master's eyes, always referring to Esau as his master. And Esau acknowledges that and he leaves. He returned on that day on his way to Seir. Yaakov goes to Sukkot, builds himself a house, and for his cattle he made booths. And therefore he called the place Sukkot. We'll talk about that today. Why did he name it after his animals? Then he gets to safely to the city of Shechem, and he buys a piece of the field, and he settles down over there, and he erects an altar, and he named it God is the God of Israel. Okay, that's our storyline. We'll now start with Rashi. Mirz Hashem will continue future weeks with Ramban and then Refersh. All right, that's our basic storyline. Let's take a look at what Rashi has to say. Okay, so into our Rashi sheets, we are on verse 12. Which is flipping bottom of page 377. Everybody see where I'll give you a second to find your place? This is quite tricky. So the verse reads again on the top, verse 12, and he said, travel on and let us go, and I will proceed alongside you. Travel, let us go together. Esav invites Yaakov to travel together, and I will go linegdecha, literally opposed you or according to you, alongside you. Rashi comments, first of all, the language of the beginning, few lines of his word are more grammatic in nature that we should travel. Going to the very bottom line on the page there. Esav, Omar Yaakov, Esav said to Yaakov, flipping over the page, Nos'a mikan, travel on from here and let us go. Rashi, much more just a grammatic type of Rashi, we're going to travel together. And I will go l'neged you, against you, or opposed to you, or, in this context, alongside you. B'shavilach, in line with you. We'll walk literally hand in hand. Neither one of us in front of the other will go to Emerson Ryan. Esav said to Yaakov, Tovazu eselach, I will do this as a favor to you, that I will extend the days of my travel by going slowly, as you need to. And this is what he meant by l'negdecha b'shavalach, in line with you. What did he? Why is it? It's a wordy statement that Esav makes. I will go alongside you l'negdecha. Drashi explains to me the meaning l'neged, against you, leading in the same line as you. And Esav says, I will even adjust my speed. I'm not even asking you. So now we already know what Yaakov's response is going to be. You're going to go too fast. Esav actually offered that in his response, in his request, in his offer, let's travel together, and I will go equivalent with you. I will allow you to dictate the pace, but just let me go along with you. Yaakov responds and says, thank you, it's very sweet, Esav, but no thank you. Verse 13, Vayom Reilav Adoni Yodei, again he says, my Lord, my master knows that the children are tender. Now note, what are the two different elements that he talks about? First, he talks about his children, that the children are tender, are rakim, and the nursing flocks and cattle are upon me, and if I drive them too hard for one day, then all the flocks will die. Why does he not mention his children? So the sages have a teaching that a righteous person never even lets certain words out of their mouth. They don't even say certain things. So you see that here, in which Yaakov alludes to that, I got two issues that I'm concerned with. I'm concerned with my tender children, and I'm concerned with my flock, and I'm concerned that if I push too hard, something bad will happen. But what are the only words that come out of his mouth? That my flock will die. What about your children? I don't even mention anything. That goes unstated because the tzaddik is very careful with that which comes out of his mouth, and there's certain things that simply do not or are not said. I know, you don't go there. You don't say it. Al tiftach peh, as it says, don't open up your mouth to the sun. You don't say it. Leave it wherever. Once it's been in the same way as the way that Hashem created the world was with what?
Dibur.
Was with dibur, was with speaking, with his words. Vayomer Elokim yihi or, Hashem said, let there be light. With his words came into existence, because the words are the reality of the world in which we live. And Hashem created us in His image as a ruach mimala, as speaking people, and the words that we say also have significance and impact, and therefore a person is very careful with their words, and they don't even let certain things out. So Yaakov says, please my master, I got very weak, tender children. I got my flock. I'm afraid that the flock will die. Let's take a look at how Rashi explains what he's saying here. Verse 13. Nursing flocks and cattle are upon me. The flocks and the cattle which are nursing are my responsibility to lead them along slowly. Rashi just explains the meaning of that. Alos means nursing, raising their young, and he brings other examples of that. If I will drive them hard for one day, this means, and if they will drive them hard for even only one day, to exhaust them on the road by running them, all the flocks will die. As if to say, even one day, I don't have the ability to keep up with you in any way. They're very tender and are sensitive, and I have to be very careful in how I travel with them. In verse 14, Yaakov continues, "Let my Lord go ahead of his servant." Just reading the pasuk on top. "Let my Lord go ahead of his servant. I will make my way at a slow pace according to the gait of the work that is before me and to the gait of the children until I come to my Lord at Seir." Let's see, Rashi. Bottom of the page on the right-hand side. It's Nahal Yaavor. "Now let my Lord go ahead. Please do not extend the days of your travel. Go ahead in your usual way, even if you will distance yourself from me." So Yaakov says, no, I know, I understand your offer. I understand that you're offering to change the way that you're going to travel, but please, go on ahead and do your regular thing, and I will make my way. This is the equivalent of Esnahel without the final hey. Li'it, moving to the next little paragraph. This means at my slow pace, an expression of unhurriedness. Going to the next paragraph, so I will go in my unhurried way, according to the gait or the foot of the work, commensurate with the requirement of the walking of the feet of the work, which is placed upon me, which is my responsibility to conduct, which is according to the gait of the children, commensurate with their feet at the pace that they are able to walk. This line of Yaakov is one of the fundamental lines in all of Jewish education, the concept of Jewish education. Yaakov here says to his brother, Esav, you want to come with me. I understand. And you're telling me that you will even slow down, but you can't slow down enough because you know what dictates my pace? What dictates my pace is the pace of the children. Es nahalali iti. Rav Moshe Eisman, who's one of the Rebbe's, Rebbeim in Neri Yisrael in Baltimore, wrote a little book. He wrote a lot of little books. One of the little books is called Of Parents and Penguins. It's a book on parenting. And in one of his chapters, he discusses at length this episode. And that phrase, I will be led, look at it, it's translated, I will be led according to the gait of the children before me. So within that line is, you know, sometimes he's not just making an argument to Esav, he's making a pedagogical statement that says, what dictates my pace? What dictates my pace are the needs of the children under my care. What it is that they need determines what it is that I need. I did one of my videos on this. You know, when you're dealing with little kids, so we as adults have an understanding of the way the world works, which in any simple example is, I have a 2 o'clock appointment, I have to get out of the house now because this is where I have to go. And children, they have no sense of time, they don't know what time it is now, they don't know where you're going, and they don't know how long it's going to take to get there. They're just doing their thing. And we impose upon them our needs. Day school starts at this time, I got work at that time, we got an appointment over here, and therefore there are all these external pressures which are imposed because we gotta go. And meanwhile, you're talking to somebody who has no clue what it is, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you know, mommy or daddy sweeps in and says, we gotta go. I'm busy playing, I'm not ready to go right now. No, we need to leave now. And so we have all of these needs, and even when we pick them up from carpool line, they're taking their time buckling themselves up. Because we see all the other cars behind who are waiting, and the whole, like, they're oblivious to that. So Yaakov really sets it up as far as they can use examples from little kids, but it goes up much, much higher than that in terms of whose pace dictates the way that things are going to go. Is it the pace of the adults who understands the way that the world works? We've got to get to a certain place at a certain time, or is it the pace of the child? And Yaakov teaches us, that it's the responsibility of the adult to take care of the child. That's my responsibility. And according to the needs of the child, I will establish my gait. My pace is established based on those needs. I think it's a whole paragraph about it. It's really a very beautiful idea. And it comes right out of there. And that's Yaakov's response. And it's when you think about the goal, it's the exile, which is really what we're going to, as we continue going through all these episodes are alluding to, when Asa says, I'll walk along with you, And Yaakov says, I'm going to work my way through this exile as slowly as I need to be able to provide for the next generation. Whatever the pace is, but my goal is taking care of the tender flock and the tender children, that nobody gets pushed too hard. So whatever is going on the outside and you want to join in and partner with me, say, you do your thing. You do your thing. I'll do it with you, Esav says. I'll change my pace to fit with yours. Yaakov, still not enough. You do your thing. I'm going to look at my children, see what it is that they need, and that's how my pace will be established. Okay, moving forward. Verse 15, Vayomer Esav, Atziga Noim Chomin Ha'om Asheri. I have one more Rashi, I'm sorry. Thank you. Yeah, I'm sorry. I wanted to stop there at that point. There's one more point. So Yaakov says, and when will I catch up to you? I'll catch up to you in Seir. There'll be this place. I'll get there. That's the place where Esav lived. Rashi says, he broadened the journey from meaning Yaakov referred to a longer journey than he intended to make. He really wasn't intending necessarily to make it all the way to Seir. But he says to Esav, I'll catch you over there. We'll meet up in Seir. He only intended to go as far as Sukkot. Why did he say this? Omar, he said to himself, if Esav indeed intends to do me harm, so let him wait until I come to him. So right now, for whatever reason, Yaakov sees in front of the children, in front of all of his wives, out here on the road, I don't know why he's not intending on doing anything. Right now, he's playing it safe. So Yaakov says, so if that's his intention, though, if he's still playing it safe, Yaakov is, if he's still afraid, so I'll go to him. Let him wait. I'll get there. But he never went. He never went. Ah, Yaakov said he was going to go. How did Yaakov say to Esav, I'm going to meet you there and then never show up? When did he go? Says in the days of the Messiah, Shenet Amar, as it says, Va'alu Moshiim Bahar Tzion Lishpot Eshor Esav, that which we read during Shacharis every morning, there will come a time, the Moshiim, the saviors will arise upon Mount Zion to mete out justice, Eshor Esav, on Mount Esav. And there are many Agadic and Midrashim to this passage, but the fact that what Yaakov is alluding to, and again, we'll see Ramban, we'll see Rav, but we see many allusions here. Yaakov says to Esav, we're in the middle of the Golas, we're traveling through, we're trudging along, it's a slow pace. And Esav says, I'll help you. Yaakov says, nah, not really, no thanks. I'll change my pace. Nah, really, it's not good. I'll catch up to you. I'll meet you in Har Seir. When are you going there? When Mashiach comes, we'll go there. We're not going to go near you. You do your thing. We'll catch up to you. There'll be a time when we will catch up to you. V'alu Moshiim b'har tzion lishpot es har Esav, the Mount of Esav, which is the Mount of Seir. There'll be a time where we'll get there, just not now. I'm just going to mention anyone who's been to our great controversies classes. So as I begin just about every single class, with this century was just a dreadful century for the Jewish people, which is the story of our exile. It's what it means to be in exile. We're constantly being persecuted, suffering. It's a long and painful history that we've been through. And at the end of that, we've shifted. Certainly the exile that we are in right now, where the world, the place where the world is at right now, and certainly in the exile of America, which is right now the Western civilization's main exile, it is primarily an exile of love. It's not an exile of persecution.
Acceptance.
Whether or not that will change, you know, Mir Tashem, it won't, but history has told us it will. But right now, at least, it's been a very positive, pleasant exile, and we're at the stage of, come, let us walk together. Not that I'm going to take your children and slaughter them, but I'm going to take your children and make them like me. And have all your children be, you know, as American as apple pie. And it's as big of a threat as we see in the Jewish world than I'm going to threaten to kill you. It's probably a worse and even greater threat because we let our guard down, as has happened in the American scene. But we are at the stage of that which we're reading right now. The stage of Esav coming and not coming out with his sword, which is what Yaakov was prepared for. He was prepared for the history of battle. This is going to be a confrontation. I need to protect myself. I need to take my women and my children and put them in the bath. I'm worried. And then Esav says, no, a hug and a kiss and an embrace and some tears and let's walk together. Let's do this biyachad, hand in hand, arm in arm. We'll sing into the sunset. And Yaakov says, no, thank you. But the stage of that exile, that's what we're in right now. And I don't mean to say this is the only stage in history. As I mentioned last night at the class, Spain began that way, and Poland began that way, and Germany began that way. There are many different stages of our exile that began that way, and then it until this point in our history, has often it turned. But the stage of the exile that we're at right now is the stage of the embrace, the hug, the kiss, and let us walk together. And Yaakov says, no thank you. When will we catch up? When will we indeed get to Esav? That's in the days of the Mashiach. Okay, flipping a page around, verse 15. Let me read, verse 15 is actually on the top of that page we just finished. Esav says, let me assign to you some of the people who are with me. Okay, fine, Esav says, you don't want me to go with you. You don't want me to change my pace. I should go ahead. At least let me leave some of the men who are with me. Let me leave them with you. And Yaakov responds to that on the top of our page. Vayomer lo mazeh. To what purpose? Em sochein be'enei Adonai. Let me find favor in my Lord's eyes. Again, constantly referring to Esav as the Lord. Let me find favor. Don't make me take your men. You go on. Let your men and you do your thing. Rashi says, to what purpose would you do me this favor, which I do not need? Meaning Esav is, as Rashi had mentioned earlier, Esav is viewing himself as doing a favor to Yaakov. Really on my own, my pace would be different. My pace would be a quicker pace. But for you, my good brother, I will change my pace. For you, I will leave my men. And the Yaakov says, please, for what purpose are you doing me a favor that I don't need? I'm not interested in that. It's not going to help me at all and I don't want it. Let me find favor in your eyes and do not do for me favors that I do not desire. Let me find favor in my Lord's eyes and do not repay me now with any compensation. The moralic sense of Rashi is coming to say here is, what just took place before this dialogue? Going back a few verses. What happened at the end of the previous little part of our episode here? There was a dialogue between Yaakov and Esav about the
tenderness of the flock.
The gifts. The previous thing.
Oh, okay.
And Esav didn't want them. And Esav said, I don't want them. And Yaakov said, I have everything. Please take. And he implored him.
And he took it.
What should then happen in normal human interaction?
Thank you, goodbye.
Well, I mean, that's one thing. The other thing could have been, I reciprocate. I offered something to you. You said, I don't want it. I don't need it. I implored you and I said, no, you're doing me the favor. Please find favor in my eyes. Accept my gift. So it would be inappropriate. Derech Eretz reciprocation for Esav to then reciprocate and say, let me accompany you. Let me help you. You know, there are all these bandits out here in the road. It's dark at night. The roads are difficult. I'll help you. I'll escort you back to wherever you want to go. And Yaakov says, no, thank you. Really, it's no good. And then Esav does exactly what Yaakov does. And he basically implores and pleads with him and says, okay, fine. So I'll go on ahead, but at least let me leave one of my men. And it would have been appropriate for Yaakov at that point, just from Derech Eretz, to say, absolutely, in the same way as you accepted my gift that you said you didn't want or didn't need. You have a lot already. But because it's a favor to me that I should find favor in your eyes, you did. It would have been appropriate for Yaakov to then say, I really don't need your men to escort me, but since that would be a favor to you, it would be a reciprocating the kindness that you've done to me, I'll take them. But Yaakov says, my children are at stake here. When you took my gift, it's okay, you have a couple extra cattle to feed. At the end of the day, you're going to come out way ahead because of the value of the gift. I gave you hundreds and hundreds of animals. But I don't want your men in my camp. I don't want them, I don't want you, I don't want your influence. I mean, he doesn't use those words, but he basically says, even though Esav is saying, do me the favor, let me reciprocate and send one of my men, Yaakov says, I don't want it. And let me find favor, that's why he uses that language, please let me find favor, my master, in your eyes, that you don't make me accept this gift of yours. Yeah.
Why is he calling me my master?
So the only thing we came up with and that we've seen so far was this constant approach that from when it began, he was very sensitive towards Esav not feeling like when he stole the blessings that he was still living off of that. That he was now, I don't know if they ever found out what the original prophecy was. It seems not. But when their mother, Rivka, was pregnant and she goes to the yeshiva of Shem to find out, she's told the elder will serve the younger. Now, I don't know whether or not they ever found out, the boys ever knew that actual prophecy. But it seems that Yaakov has a very distinct sensitivity towards never imposing that it should look like the elder is indeed serving the younger, and therefore he goes to the other extreme regularly. We've seen this from every single dialogue from this whole episode. Every time he refers to his brother, always as my master or my lord. Esav refers to Yaakov as
brother.
My brother. Let's walk together, my brother. Let's be together. And Yaakov always says, no thanks, I'm not interested. I don't want that companionship with you. And he always refers to him as a master. It seems, I'm giving a simple shot, I'm sure many of the commentators will have much more to say, it seems just on that level of, it hasn't been fulfilled, you're still the older brother, you're still, you're still the man, and I'm just subservient to you. It seems like it's a sign of humility. Yeah, right? Okay, moving on. Right, that was the end of verse 14, in which Rashi explains, do not repay me now with any compensation. In other words, why any compensation? Meaning, it would have made sense for you to want to compensate me for all that I've done to you, and I'm begging you, please don't try to compensate me now. You just go on up ahead. Verse 16, just on the top of the verse, so Esav went back that day to his way toward Seir. Vayoshev vayomahu Esav lidarko. Seir, Esav returned that way. Now, this grammatical structure of the pasuk is odd. That it says that Vayoshev, it should have said Vayoshev Esav Bayomo. In other words, in English, the English translation put it into normal English. So it doesn't read odd at all. It says, so Esav went back that day on his way to Seir. But the Hebrew says, and he went back on that day, Esav, to his way to Seir. The grammatical structure of the verse is a little bit odd, which tipped off the sages that there was something here. Sages write, as Rashi quotes here in verse 16, Vayoshev Bayomahu Esav Lidarko. So Esav started back on that day on his way. Esav Levado. Esav alone. The pasuk reads as who went back? It's as if it's stressing it was only Esav who went back. Because it says it in a strange way, as if to highlight that. So Rashi asks, V'arba Meos Ish Shehocho Imo, what happened to the 400 men who were with him? Why would the Torah specifically hint that at the end of this episode, Esav goes home alone, when it went out of its way to tell us numerous times that who's coming with him? 400 men, where are they? Says Rashi, those 400 men, nishmetu me'etz lo, they slipped away from him, echad, echad, one by one, they slowly dropped off. Esav turns around, he begins his journey back, and slowly but surely one of them, slips behind, goes a little bit slower, takes a restroom break, doesn't join in, takes a stop off at the next little town. So that slowly but surely, as this force of 400 gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, so that by the time he returns home, he's traveling all by himself. Continues Rashi, V'heichan parlem HaKodesh Baruch Hu, when did Hashem, the Holy One, blessed be He, repay him? The sages see in that an act of virtue, that these men dropped off from being part of the army of Esav. When were they repaid? She says, "Bimei David, during the days of David HaMelech." As the pasuk in Sefer Shmuel writes, "Ki im arba meos ishnara sherochvu al agmalim." And David struck them; no one escaped, but for 400 men, lads who rode upon the camels. The Navi there speaks of the attack. If you want to read the note there in verse 4. That David attacked against the Amalekites, who were descendants of Esav. One of Esav's children's name was Amalek. And the 400 men escaped as a reward for the abandonment of Esav here of his 400 companions. So obviously it wasn't the same 400 people, we're talking hundreds of years later. But the nation was rewarded, the descendants of Esav were rewarded, that these 400 men said, we don't really want to have anything to do with Esav anymore. So the Navi hints to that, by saying hundreds of years later, when David HaMelech attacks a certain group, and everybody was destroyed except for 400 men who knew how to ride camels. Why is that relevant. Who cares? Let's say they did escape. They didn't escape. What it doesn't matter to us. So sages point out it matters because you need to know that piece of information. That's the repayment that the nation of Esav had. That when these people dropped off from being part of him, they were rewarded later. And this fits in with I don't have the exact phrase at the tip of my fingers, but the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos describes in the same way. As it's very meritorious to join in, it's a Mishnah in Maseches Makos, is really where I was wanted to quote it from. The Mishnah there says that in the same way that a person can join a group of people to do evil things, the Mishnah there, so just a very brief background, the Mishnah is talking about false witnesses who testify against somebody. They incur a certain punishment for doing so. What if instead of usually how many is a group of witnesses? Two. What if they were a group of three? Three people conspired together that they're going to testify against a certain innocent man because they don't like him, they want to get him into trouble. And all three do so, they conspire, and then they're caught. So the Mishnah says, the third one, you might have thought, could make an argument and say, I didn't really do anything. I really don't deserve the punishment that the first two get. Because the first two created the testimony. Without the two of them, there would be nothing. So now there's two. I just joined in, but I didn't change, I didn't add, I didn't take away. Nothing was accomplished by my adding myself to this group. The group was here already in a way that could have created exactly what it needed to create. I should be off the hook from punishment. So the Mishnah teaches in Maseches Makos that if a group of three comes forward and are false witnesses, we punish all three in the same way as we punish the first two, and that a person who joins in to do an Avero, joins into such an evil group, there's no such thing as saying it would have happened without me. When you join, you're part of it. And the Mishnah says, and if that's true when it comes to punishment, if that's true when it comes to joining in negative things, how much more so, alachas kama v'kama, that if there's a group of Jews who are engaged in doing some type of a mitzvah, and you join them, and it wouldn't have really added anything, whatever they were going to do would have happened with or without you, but when you become a part of it, how much more so then is the reward given to you as if you were the only cause of it being done? So Mishnah says, whenever you have an opportunity, whatever it may be, and you say, and someone's doing it already, it might be true. Well, you could join it anyway. Join it anyway. And the reward for joining in is as if you were the only source of it being done. So in the same way the person needs to desist from being part of an evil act, the person needs to join together. So here you see the soldiers of Esav after meeting up with Yaakov, whom they had never met. If you just imagine being one of those 400 men. They never met Yaakov. Yaakov and Esav have been separated for easily 20 years. And at the time that they were together, Esav didn't have this army. So Esav recruits this army. So they join in, and then they meet him. Right? They meet Yaakov. They meet his four wives. They meet his children. And they probably saw that there was something different about him than Esav, if I had to venture a guess. And on the way back from that meeting, they peel away. And they say, we're not interested anymore. We don't want to be part of this army. And so the sages tell us, the Torah wants to point that out to us. The Torah wants to point out that there were 400 men who were part of Esav's army, and after they met Yaakov, they had no interest in being part of Esav anymore. And it hints at it by saying the phrase in a very strange way that Esav returned to Seir alone, because the structure of the verse is backwards to point that out, and to point out that the descendants of that nation will reap the benefits of that. Because years, years, years later, when there's a war will take place, there'll be 400 who will be spared in payment of that which the 400 here did. Okay, so far so good? Let us move forward. 17. So Esav disappears. He's out of the scene. We will not come across Esav again in the Torah because he's going to pop up again when they bury Yitzchak. Mm-hmm. I'll show up a little bit over there. Yaakov Nasa Sukkosa. Yaakov travels to the place called Sukkos. Vayivin lo bais, and he built for himself a house. Ulemekneu asa Sukkos, and to his cattle he made booths. Alkein Karo Hashem Hamakom Sukkos. That's why they call the name of the place Sukkos. Rashi points out an interesting thing. Verse 17, he built himself a house. He stayed there 18 months. A summer, a winter, and a summer. How do you know that? Says Rashi, because Sukkos, let's look at how many times does it say that he was in or built Sukkos. So it says Sukkos because he built shelters for his animals, which implies it was summer. It says he built a bais, which implies a house is winter. And then it says Sukkos, a second shelter, implying that it was another summer. He traveled to Sukkos. So the first time it says the word Sukkos, that's where he traveled, to implies that he built these Sukkos for his cattle springtime. He built himself a house, implies that it was summer. Then he built booths again, winter, excuse me. Then he built another Sukkos. So that implies that it was another spring. So you see, says Rashi, it was like an 18-month period that he went through the full cycle of a summer, winter, summer while he was there. And then he travels, verse 18, Vayavo Yaakov Shalem Ir Shechem. He then traveled intact or whole to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. And he encamped there before the city, says Rashi in verse 18. Shalem, what do you mean that he came there intact? How else would you get to a city intact? Rashi says, Shalem Begufa means he was intact bodily, for he was cured of his limp. Shalem B'mamon, he was intact regarding his money, that he did not lose anything despite his big ordeal with Esav. And Shalem Mikol also Doron, even at, he didn't lose it from a gift of the gift that he had given to Esav, excuse me. And Shalem B'torosom, he was intact in his Torah, Shalosh Shachach Talmudo B'veis Lavan, that he did not forget any of his learning that he had done with his father and from Shem and from Eber while he was in the house of Lavan. So there were three levels of his achieving or arriving in Shechem intact. He was intact physically, healed from the ordeal with the angel. He was intact monetarily, even despite the fact that he gave over 500 animals to Esav, his brother. And he was intact spiritually, that he returned home after some 20-odd years with his uncle Lavan, and he had not forgotten or lost any of his Torah scholarship while he was away. Similarly, if you skip down two paragraphs to the paragraph that starts, upon his coming from Paddan Aram, where he got to Shechem, and the Torah tells us where he came from Paddan Aram, like a person who comes, who says to his friend, Yotzaploni Mibesh Shnei Arayah, so-and-so emerged from between two lions and still came intact unharmed, meaning he was in danger, and he arrived in, like, who do you say that you came intact? I only say that I arrived intact if there would be good reason to think I would not have arrived. Nobody says, I drove from shul, I made it in one piece. I mean, it's sort of like a phrase, but it's an odd phrase, right? I made it in one piece.
They did it 2 months ago. Yeah, tomorrow
right.
They will too.
Right? No, exactly. In other words, if someone would say, I got home in one piece after an ordeal, like last week, so you're saying, I went through an ordeal, say, how was it? I got home in one piece. I made it home. But on a regular day, I drove home in one piece, like, well, why are you saying that? So it says Rashi, you say that when you're involved in an ordeal. So here too, he came intact, meaning from Paddan Aram, which was Lavan, and from Esav, who confronted him on his journey. Vayikan Etzchokos Hasada 19, he bought the parcel of field upon which he pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 kesita, which was a specific amount of money, Zashi points out. And again, we point this out, and we just mentioned again, right now he's outside the city of Shechem and he's buying it from the children of Hamor, who was Shechem's father. Shechem is going to be the prince who's going to abduct Dinah later on in the next parsha or two. And so there's already a dealing between Yaakov and Shechem, or Hamor, his father at least, even before that abduction, in that Yaakov purchases land from Hamor to dwell and pitch his tent outside of the city. And last little piece. Last verse, Vayotzav Shom Mizbeach, and he erected an altar there, and he called it God is the God of Israel. Vayikra lo Kel Elokei Yisrael. Says Rashi, an important last Rashi to cover here, verse 20, and he called it God is the God of Israel. Lo Sham Mizbeach Kari Elokei Yisrael. Not that the altar is called the God of Israel, meaning Rashi saying, if you read the verse straight, he built an altar, and he called it God is the God of Israel. What did he call the God that God is the God of Israel? It sounds like he called the altar that. Says Rashi, no. Not that he called the altar that, rather, Al Shem Shahoya Kadosh Baruch Hu Imo, because the Holy One, blessed is He, was with him, Vihitzilo, and rescued him, therefore he called the name of the altar after the miracle, so that the praise of the omnipresent shall be mentioned through the proclamation of the name of the altar. So he wanted to name the altar after the miracle, and what did he do? He said, as if to say, He who is God, Mishu who Kel, He who is God, that is, the Holy One, blessed is He. He is a God for me, whose name is Israel. Period. So that you read the verse, and he called it, God is the God of Israel. As if to say, He who is the one who is God, is the God for me. My name is Israel. So the God of me, Israel, is the God who saved me. And therefore, whenever you will reference this altar, you will reference the miracle that Hashem had had saved him. Similar in Rashi, we find that by Moshe, Vayikra Shem Hashem Nisiyeh, called Hashem is my miracle. Not that the altar was called Hashem, but that he called the name of the altar after the miracle to mention the praise of the Holy One. Hashem is my miracle. Okay, without getting bogged down in the details of that, basically Rashi is saying is that this the very last verse of our episode, which is going to conclude all of our episodes of Yaakov and Esau, the very last, the end, the final thing that the Torah has to say about Yaakov and Esau, after Esau parts ways, Yaakov makes it to Shechem, he makes it intact, he buys himself a plot of land, he settles down, and he erects an altar to give thanks to Hashem. He calls it an Ah name, he calls it Kael Elokei Yisrael, God is the God of the Jewish people. And Rashi says, he didn't name the altar that, he gave the altar a name, which would, whenever it was referenced by somebody, would reference the miraculous event that Yaakov had experienced, that he was saved. And so through the calling of the altar, would always be a praise given to Hashem, that Hashem had been the one who was there for Yaakov and spared him. So that the name implies that. And this is a common tool, I guess I would say, that the sages would employ, that the Avos, the forefathers employed, that the name that was given was something that would always exude meaning, so that anyone who referenced the name would sort of, by definition, be referencing something else of significance. Fine, that's what I want to, you know, that's as far as the Rashi, I want to go through the details of it, how exactly he worked with the grammar out of the of this phraseology. He named the altar in a way that would always recall God's kindness to him. Okay, that was okay. One last medrash that Rashi quotes. V'avoseinu darshu, our rabbis expounded it as saying the following. Now again, the language of what Yaakov called it was strange. V'yikra lo is, and he called it. Now, Art Scroll on the top of the translation expresses it correctly. And he called it, is a lowercase h or a capital H?
Small.
It's a small h. So who called it God is the God of Israel? It's Yaakov calling either altar or calling Hashem that. But in Hebrew, because Hebrew doesn't have pronouns in that way, he built a mizbeach, Vayikra lo kel, Elokei Yisrael, can just as easily be read as Yaakov erected the mizbeach, and God called to him kel, as if Yaakov was a god. Very strange statement. But sages say it. Let's look at the sages inside. Our rabbis expanded it as saying that the Holy One, blessed is He, called Yaakov God. Vayikra lo, and he called him Kel. Who called him that? Elokei Yisrael, the God of the Jewish people, called to Yaakov as a God. Rashi continues, and the words of the Torah are as a hammer that shatters a rock, dividing into many lines of reasoning. But I have come to resolve the simple meaning of the text. So Rashi concludes as sages have a lot to say in that. That statement has within it buried deep wisdom. And he quotes the verse that when you take a rock to and shatter it with a hammer, the rock will explode into hundreds of little pieces. In the same way, when you take a verse in the Torah and you apply to it the wisdom of the sages, the meaning of the verse can explode into hundreds of different meanings. So, but I'm not engaged in that. My job is to give you the simple meaning of the verse. The simple meaning of the verse is that lowercase Yaakov called, not the altar, but called to God, the God of the Jewish people, the God of Israel. That's the simple meaning. But because the Torah can be shattered into many different rocks, the many different ways of looking at the verse, And one of them, Rashi says, is that God himself, capital H, called Yaakov a God. Strange indeed. What does that mean? So the Maral explains, and I'm not going to do this justice because I forgot my Maral upstairs, so I'm just going to say it over outside, but maybe we'll pick up with this. We'll see if we need to. Maral explains the concept of a God. The word El means powerful. Micha Moicha Be'eli Lim Hashem. Who is like you amongst all the powerful, Hashem? We have a meaning of the word El as a divine name, as a God, but the word means the powerful one, the one in control. So Maral explains that I'll say the words and then whatever we understand, that we understand for it. When we use the word El in a divine sense, referring to a godly being, what we're saying is that you are the powerful one in the heavenly spheres who controls all of that. And Hashem was saying to Yaakov, now that you have gone through what you've just been through, you fled from your parents' home, from Esau to Lavan. You lived with Lavan all of those years, in exile, far away from the Torah of your father, far away from the warm embrace of your parents' home. You battled Lavan for 20 years, Esav, Esav's angels, and have now returned back to the land of Israel intact spiritually, intact physically, intact monetarily. What you now represent, as again, this whole episode alludes to the Jewish people's traveling through history, through our long exile, dealing with Esav as our final stop. Hashem refers to Yaakov and says, you are the prime force in the Tachtonim. Just like I am the God on the Elyonim, in the upper worlds, you are the El, not in the sense of a divine God, but the source of power in the lower realms. And it's to you that the world will look for strength and for guidance and for leadership. And at the end of this episode in which you dealt with the conniving Lavan and Esav and his desire to walk with you, and intact, you made it through all of those. So Hashem responds to Yaakov when Yaakov builds the altar, and Hashem then names Yaakov and says, you are an El also. Not in a divine sense, but in the world you occupy the role of that force of power, leadership, and guidance. Well, there's much more to say, but that's when you ask, like, what does that mean? So the word El means many things. It doesn't just mean in a divine sense. And in its non-divine meaning, sages are seeing within this illusion that Hashem says to Yaakov, that's your role. You need to know that that's your role. You need to know that that's the position you're going to occupy in the world, that position of strength, position of power, the position of leadership. And in the same way as I am singular and unique in the world of the Elyonim, in the world of the spheres above, you are going to be singular and unique in the worlds below, and are going to have to shoulder that responsibility and fulfill and carry out that mission to the world. And that's represented when Hashem calls Yaakov an El, a one of power, one of leadership. All right.
Thank you.
We'll pick up with Mirza Hashem with the Ramban next week. Start with Ramban, do it first. Okay, have a great day. Yeah. A safe day.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.